judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. This court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman First Class Nehrul Maliwat, ACM 38579. The appellant presents two issues for our consideration during arguments today. They are, first, whether the military judge abused his discretion by providing a propensity instruction under MRE 413 when he did not perform his analysis on the record, and the government did not provide notice of its intent to argue propensity at least 5 days in advance of trial. And second, whether appellant was denied his right under the Sixth Amendment to effective assistance of counsel when his attorney did not introduce certain text messages that occurred between the appellant and the victim. Are both sides ready to present argument? The
gentleman is ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant's counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge.
Senior Judge Hecker, Judge Teller, I introduced myself the last time. Is it Judge Santoro?
Yes.
Your Honor, it's a pleasure to meet you. My name is William Casera, and along with my co-counsel, Major Isaac Cannon, we represent Airman Maliwat. As the court has said, there are two issues for appeal, the first of those being that the military judge abused his discretion when he provided the propensity instruction under MRE 413 and failed to place his analysis for doing so on the record. Your Honor, there are three parts to this argument. The first is that the government failed to provide the notice. The second is that the judge abused his discretion by failing to do the 413 analysis. And third is that the government failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the allegations involving KM were true. Your Honors, there's two cases that I would like the court to consider sort of as a backdrop of all of this. The first is the Solomon case that we cite in our brief, which discusses what use can be made of a prior acquittal of an accused. And the second is the Bass case, the case that the government cites in their supplemental brief. We want to make it clear that our argument in this case is not that the government can under no circumstances use a 120 allegation or a sexual assault allegation when an appellant is charged with two sexual assault allegations, that there are no circumstances in which one can be used against each other under MRE 413. That is what Bass says. That is not what the appellant says in this case. Certainly, it can be done. It has to be done correctly. And that is what Solomon tells us is how it is to be done.
Well, counsel, if I understand the way you've broken down your argument in the three prongs, your first is there was no notice provided. What's the source of the requirement that there be notice provided?
Your Honor, I don't, you know what, it is in the RCM, it's in the Hudgens case. I don't know the number off the top of my brain.
Well, that's right. The reason I ask is, if we look at 413, the plain text of 413 does not require notice. It says, in a court-martial in which the government intends to offer evidence under this rule, the government shall disclose the evidence to the accused, but thereafter it doesn't say anything about notice in terms of notice. It simply is a disclosure of evidence rule, at least according to the text. So is there some other source of the notice obligation?
Judge, can I get back with you?
Certainly.
Certainly Hudgens says that you have to provide that notice. And I think Hudgens does use the five-day rule. I will be honest with you, Judge. I've been operating under the five-day rule, sort of knowing it's there and not really knowing from where it came. But we will certainly provide that to the court.
And as you consider your response to that question, which I presume we'll get in your rebuttal argument.
Yes, sir.
When you look at Hudgens, I think you'll see that Hudgens was an unpublished decision of a three-judge panel of this court, and that statement, I think, in Hudgens can be viewed as dicta because, at least as I read Hudgens, that issue wasn't specifically briefed, nor was there an analysis done by the panel of the source of that purported notice.
Judge, while I'm not sure if the court is aware of this, I'm intimately aware of Hudgens since I was the appellate counsel in that case. I did not view that as dicta when I read it, but we will certainly address that in our rebuttal.
Thank you.
So the first part is the government failed to provide the propensity notice. In the instant case, whether you use 5 days or whether you use in advance of trial, the government failed to provide notice in advance of trial and in violation of both MRE 413 and in Hudgens. And, Your Honor, there is a very good reason why the manual requires notice and why I think it is clear that the intent is that it be done ahead of trial, because it will affect everything that happens during a trial. One can certainly look at a case like this and say it had a significant impact on the trial proceedings. What is that impact? With all due respect to the drafters of the manual, there's probably no more confusing part of the manual, or certainly no more confusing part of the law right now, than the interaction of MRE 413 and the spillover instruction. Had the defense known that that instruction was going to be given, it is entirely possible, and I think even likely, that the forum selection in this case would have been different. It may have been a bench trial. It may have been an officer panel. You will notice that this was an enlisted panel. Those types of decisions are made before trial, hence the requirement of MRE 413. It may well have affected the way that they cross-examined the alleged victim, or victims in this case, and it may well have affected whether the accused testified in this case. That is why there is the requirement that the propensity instruction or the propensity notice be given. And when it is not given, as such, the military judge abused his discretion by giving the propensity instruction.
Does it matter?
There's no dispute, is there, counsel, that the evidence would have been admissible in some form given that it was charged conduct?
In some form? You mean as in would the alleged victim be able to get up and testify?
Correct.
Of course, because he was charged with that offense.
So just to clarify, you're not arguing that the evidence was inadmissible. We're simply arguing the purpose for which it was admitted, or the instruction that was given after it was admitted.
Yes, Your Honor. It was admissible to show whether or not he was guilty by, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Judge?
To the extent that there wasn't an objection to the admissibility under 413, was this objection preserved, especially as it relates to the military judge's failure to put his findings on the record?
Oh, Judge, I believe that the defense certainly laid a sufficient objection when they objected to the instruction itself, putting the court on notice, and the judge is required to put their findings on the record regardless. I mean, when he says, I'm going to allow this instruction over defense objection, he's got an obligation to put his rationale for doing so on the record.
But whether you believe that the judge's statement, are there any other objections, adequately preserved the objection to the instruction, there certainly was no objection under 403 or any objection citing 413 directly in terms of the admissibility for propensity purposes.
I would disagree, Judge. I think
Can you point me in the record where those were preserved?
Well, they made the objection to the instruction being given. If you're making an objection to the instruction being given, I think the underlying reason is because you believe the evidence is inadmissible. Or at least that's part of it.
Or do you believe that notice wasn't provided?
Which would be the other part of it.
So I'm wondering how the judge is supposed to know what he's supposed to put on the record if there are equally plausible alternatives to why the objection is being made. Whose responsibility is it to make plain the purpose of the objection?
Well, it is the defense responsibility, but it is also the military judge as the gatekeeper to inquire. And that is their responsibility in this case. And he failed to do so. And the military judge failed to abuse his discretion by failing to do the 413 analysis or the 403 balancing test. The military judge failed to find, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the allegations involving KM actually occurred. And as we're going to discuss below...
Is that what he has to find, or does he have to find that the members could find that?
That the members could find that. And as discussed below, it did not meet that standard. As such, the military judge's ruling should be given little deference. There are several things that I'd like to talk about as it relates to that application of and that prong of our argument. First off, while certainly not dispositive, it is instructive for this court that the appellant was acquitted of the offense. But we do not make the argument, nor would we, that it is dispositive. You have the investigating officer's finding that there was no probable cause to proceed. There is, I think the law is clear that probable cause is a lower standard than preponderance of the evidence. Again, not binding on the court, but it is certainly something that is instructive. And if this court is going to have to conduct its own 413 analysis, as we believe you must, it is something that the court may consider. And indeed, this court must now do its own 413 balancing test without input from the defense and by looking at the entire record, including the allied papers. And then the third part of the test, Your Honors, is that KM's allegations were, quite candidly, flimsy at best. If you recall from the investigating officer's report, also noted in the 1105 submissions, noted in my brief, allegations defy the laws. The investigating officer said that they defy the laws of physics, but they were incredible as relates to the evidence of the allegation that occurred in the car and the allegation that occurred in the dorm. The investigating officer simply said, there's no evidence this even happened. So you've got at least one independent attorney saying, on the first instance, it doesn't meet a probable cause standard. On the second instance, it doesn't even look like it ever happened. It was clear that this allegation was bootstrapped on to secure a conviction on the charges involving J.M. Because as we note in our factual and legal sufficiency argument, otherwise the allegations involving J.M. were extremely weak. And this is exactly the prohibited purpose for which our superior court has said that that instruction must be, or that analysis must be put on the record.
Counsel, I know you disagree with whether the propensity instruction should have been given, but in your view, was the instruction that was given a correct statement of the law?
Yes. Subject to questions from the members of the court, I think that's the quickest I've ever done an assignment of error, and I'm about to beat that record in my next assignment of error.
Okay, if you believe that that instruction was legally correct, how do you distinguish in Burton where all three of the opinions of the court cited as the appropriate remedy a propensity instruction?
Well, Judge, we don't. Again, our problem is not, the question in this case is not whether or not the allegations involving KM could have been used. They have to be used properly. The proper way to do it is to provide notice.
Right, and in Burton, the court found that it was improper argument for the trial counsel to make a propensity argument because none of that had been done.
Right.
It procedurally wasn't done correctly. Not that the underlying evidence was admissible, but the procedures weren't followed. And they said the remedy for that, all three separate opinions said the remedy for that would have been a propensity instruction.
Well, in this case, Judge, the remedy is proper notice, and for this court now have to do a 413 balancing test on its own. That is the unfortunate position the government has put the court, and I don't mean my opposing counsel here, of course, but the government, as in the big government, the triers of this case. Secondly, Your Honors, the appellant was denied the right to the effective assistance of counsel when his ADC inexplicably did not introduce a series of text messages that tended to demonstrate that appellant reasonably believed J.M. consented. Your Honors, I've laid the text messages out in my brief. I don't think there's any need for me to read them here. The ADC obviously felt these text messages were of great importance as he submitted them during the 1105 process. Candidly, we do not know why the ADC did not use them during the merits, but it is inexplicable that they did not, and it clearly fell below the measure of a competent attorney, the reasonable standard of a competent attorney under the same circumstances. It is simply inexplicable that he would not admit them at trial or to cross-examine J.M. with them. If the court remembers, one of the main issues in this case was whether or not there had been a prior consensual relationship between J.M. and the appellant. J.M. said we had had sexual contact or sexual intercourse on one occasion. The appellant had given a sworn statement, did not testify, but obviously by the cross-examination of J.M., the court knows that the defense in this case with this had been a long-term ongoing sexual relationship and that J.M. was therefore lying. The text messages that we have laid out in our brief would clearly indicate to a finder of fact that there had been a much more involved sexual relationship than J.M. was stating, and that her testimony was untruthful. Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like you to make that clear and make that plain for us. Can you kind of expand on the logical inference that you draw from her, what I think you could best characterize as equivocal responses to some of those texts, to an inference that sex either was desired or occurred on those occasions?
Judge, with all due respect, I do not think that there is anything unequivocal about when in response to him telling her, I love gentle kisses, then mixing it up by getting a bit rough, and she says, I could tell, that there's anything equivocal about whether or not that related to a sexual contact, or sexual intercourse between the two of them at a time frame when she says they were not having sex. And when he says, the language that is on page 28 of my brief, we'll leave it at that, that that is clearly an indication that they had had sexual intercourse at a time post when the alleged victim said that they had. I do not believe there is anything at all equivocal about her response.
So I take your point on the first one. On the remainder of them, you would suggest that her responses are not equivocal? When she says, for example, when he proposes a sexual act, she says, well, we'll see about that last part.
Right. I mean, I think that a reasonable person, the reasonable fact finder would look at that and say, that is an indication that they have had recent sexual contact. Or else she would have said, absolutely not. We've had the talk. I believe there's nothing unequivocal, nothing equivocal about her responses. They tended to show that she consented, or more importantly, Your Honor, that he reasonably believed that she did. And it's important for the court to remember that the main defense in this case was not just consent, but it was also a reasonable mistake of fact as it relates to defense. The appellant receiving those messages would reasonably believe, or could reasonably believe, that she was consenting to further sexual contact. That information was left away from the fact finder, leaving them with an incomplete picture. There's no rational reason for doing so, and as a result, this court should reverse the appellant's conviction.
So, aren't we precluded from finding ineffective assistance of counsel here when we haven't heard from the counsel about what the rationale?
Judge, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard
time.
Are
we precluded from finding ineffective assistance of counsel when we haven't heard from the defense counsel about tactical reasons or other explanations for failing to introduce this evidence?
Your Honor, I think United States versus Lewis clearly states out what this court can do. And if the court believes that we have met our burden of showing prejudice, then this court, you know, the CAF decision lays out the framework of the next actions taken by this court, whether that be a Dubay hearing or whether that be, affidavits under U.S. v. Lewis. So again, subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes my presentation. Thank you, judges.
Whenever you're ready.
Senior Judge Hacker, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not err by providing the court members with a propensity instruction pursuant to Military Rule of Evidence 413 in appellant's case. Furthermore, this court cannot find ineffective assistance of counsel at this stage because it has not ordered affidavits from trial defense counsel. Even so, appellant's unsupported allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel do not overcome the strong presumption that his counsel were competent. Before I delve into the heart of my argument, I would ask this court to keep in mind an essential fact as it considers the evidence and the arguments in this case. Appellant essentially confessed to the rape of JM for which he was convicted. In the text message conversation after the rape, JM tells appellant, "I said no." Appellant replied, "I know. I couldn't control myself. The more you said no, the more I wanted you." The evidence in this case was absolutely overwhelming, and that context should be at the forefront of this court's mind when considering whether or not any error in this case was harmless or whether or not a different trial strategy by trial defense counsel would have made a difference in the outcome of this case. Now, of course, the United States contends that there was no error, plain or otherwise, in the military judge's decision to give a propensity instruction in this case. And the proper standard of review is plain error in this case because defense counsel failed to articulate an objection on the record. The military judge's words asking, are there any other objections?
I mean, isn't that a pretty important word when he says other objections?
Your Honor, I think we can't look only at the words of the military judge. We have to look at the words of the defense counsel, the trial defense counsel. And trial defense counsel had opportunity to assert an objection, and she did not do so. She simply did not do so in this case.
But what would have been the point? Because wasn't the chronology that the trial judge was initially not going to give the instruction, then he essentially reconsidered himself, and he articulated the reason he, for lack of a better word, reconsidered his earlier position, So what else would have been left for trial defense counsel to say to flesh out the argument?
Well, again, trial defense counsel could have potentially put on the record the fact that they were not ready to defend against a propensity argument. They had that opportunity there. They did not do so. They could have stated why they didn't think a propensity instruction was warranted under the circumstances. And again, they simply did not do so. There was an opportunity to do so, but we can't just look at the context of other things that were said in the record or what was said by the military judge and try to infer what trial defense counsel would have said. Trial defense counsel has a duty to preserve objections on the record, and frankly, it just wasn't done in this case, and it wouldn't be appropriate for us to speculate at this particular time what trial defense counsel may or may not have been thinking.
But when the judge says other objection, isn't the reasonable inference from that your objection is noted? Do you have anything else to say?
It may be a reasonable inference, Your Honor, but again, we don't know what was said, and I think it would be going too far for us to try to read trial defense counsel's mind as to exactly what she was intending to object to in that particular case. The objection simply was not preserved by the words that trial defense counsel actually said on the record. And again, it is trial defense counsel's duty to preserve objections. It just simply was not done in this case, Your Honor. Now, as a threshold matter in this case, the United States would ask this court to join the Army and Navy Courts of Criminal Appeals in holding that multiple charged incidents of sexual assault may be used as propensity evidence at trial, and that a propensity instruction may be appropriate under those circumstances. I don't believe that that's something that this court has ever specifically held in the past, but the Army and Navy courts have recently done so in Barnes and Bass, which the citations of which we have provided to this court.
What's your position on the form of or the notice requirement for 413 evidence? Is there a notice requirement, as appellant is arguing?
Well, as you yourself, Your Honor, pointed out, there is no specific use of the word notice in the rule. Certainly, trial counsel must provide the defense counsel with any type of statements used or a summary of any type of expected testimony to come out. But again, there's nothing in the plain language of the rule itself that calls for any other specific type of notice.
I understand that, but the question is, what is the position of the United States? Is there a notice requirement in the rule?
There's not a notice requirement other than to provide the statements or a summary of the evidence, Your Honor.
So how do we square that position with what we said in Hudgens?
Well, Your Honor, I think Hudgens, again, was a case that dealt with a motion to sever two sexual assault allegations at trial. And the United States does view the particular citation that appellant mentions as being dicta in that case. And I think that when this court made that comment, it was in dicta, and it did not take into account the fact that the rule also gives the military judge considerable discretion to deviate from that 5-day notice standard. So I don't believe that Hudgens stands for the proposition that if you do not, give some sort of notice, that just there's a blanket rule then that 413 evidence cannot come in, because certainly the rule builds in other considerations that the judge may take into consideration for waiving or allowing deviation from that 5-day requirement to provide the statements, which we may refer to it as notice, but again, it's simply a requirement to provide the statements or a summary of the evidence that's going to come in. So again, my answer to that, Your Honor, is that I don't believe that Hudgens takes into consideration the military judge's considerable discretion. And that's what we saw in this case. We saw the military judge look at the facts of what had happened in trial, saw the fact that trial defense counsel in this case had been aware of the other charge, the charge against KM, since well before the Article 32. And in that sense, he found that whatever we want to call the notice requirement of MRA 413, he found it to have been met in this case. And so it was certainly an exercise of his discretion. Again, we're talking about a plain error standard here, but even if it was an abuse of discretion standard here, the military judge certainly did not abuse his discretion, especially considering the fact that at the time the military judge said he was going to give the instruction, trial defense counsel didn't articulate at any point that they were not ready or that lack of notice was a specific issue.
But none of the analysis you just provided for us is anywhere in the record, is it, with respect to the military judge's decision about whether notice was timely or not, or how it may have been used? As I heard your argument, it sounded as though you were saying that at the time the instruction was requested, the military judge had observed what had happened at trial, determined that it was appropriate based on what had happened at trial. But appellant's argument, I think, before us seems to be that they would have made different tactical decisions at the front end had they known what the permissible argument and instructions would have been. So at the point you're arguing the judge is making these determinations about is the instruction proper or not, I take the appellant's position to be that that's too far attenuated, the cat's out of the bag at that point. The appropriate time for the appellant to know how the evidence was going to be used was before the case began.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think this goes into the military judge's discretion, and on page 569 of the record, that's where the military judge does give his reasoning for changing his mind and actually giving the instruction, and he notes there that trial counsel was correct when he stated that the language of 413 states that as long as they've given you the evidence, including the witness statements, 5 days prior to trial, then it's allowable. I mean, that would have been a perfect time, Your Honor, for trial defense counsel to say, oh, well, I would have done this differently if I had known that the government was going to seek to make a propensity argument. I would have had a different forum selection, et cetera. But now this is simply hindsight by appellant at this point after he's already been convicted making these complaints. The time to make complaints and to object would have been at trial rather than some retrospective after he's already been convicted. Now, Your Honor, the appellant's two main complaints, we've talked about one of them, the lack of notice. His other main complaint is that the military judge did not perform an MRE 401 or 403 analysis or an analysis of the right factors on the record. And again, the United States argues at this particular point that it was not plain error. There was no settled case law at this particular time telling the military judge that in order to give a propensity instruction in a case such as this, where both instances of sexual assault were charged, that he had to do an analysis on the record in order to admit that particular evidence. And so, because there was no settled case law at this particular time, it simply was not plain error for the military judge not to do it in this particular case. Nor, if we get past that and we get to the question of, well, whether or not it was plain error just to choose to give the instruction to decide to give the instruction, it was still not plain error, or it was not plain error either to give the propensity instruction. And that is, if this court were to conduct a balancing test, it would be quite obvious that this evidence is admissible, and it certainly wasn't plain error for the military judge to do so. I don't want to necessarily go through an entire analysis of 401 and the right factors and 403 because I've done so in my brief, but I do want to highlight a couple of points here. Appellant in his brief talks about the fact that, well, the government hasn't shown that this conduct happened by a preponderance of the evidence. But that's not the standard. The standard is whether or not a panel could find by a preponderance of the evidence that the conduct occurred. And certainly in this case, a panel could find that the conduct occurred. We have to look at the facts of this case. The appellant, he concedes that an acquittal does not mean, just because appellant was acquitted of the offense against KM, that doesn't mean that the evidence could not be admissible as propensity evidence. It certainly could. And we have to look at the surrounding facts of this particular case. We have KM who got up and testified at trial. Her testimony to some extent was corroborated by text messages that she had sent at the time that were taken off appellant's phone, where she's chastising appellant. She's chastising him for continuing to make sexual advances toward her. She's telling him that she does not want to engage in certain acts. And then she reprimands him for touching her inappropriately in public or while she is driving. So there's corroboration for statements that she's making or for her testimony in court. It's also important that the evidence did not suggest any motive to fabricate whatsoever on the part of KM at trial. And it's also important to know KM and JM, they did not know each other. There wasn't as if there was any collusion or so at trial. KM was in fact identified as a witness based on a search of appellant's phone in relation to the charges against JM. So again, the evidence in this case, when you look at the totality, it certainly meets that standard of a court panel could find by a preponderance of the evidence that it happened. Then when you go into an analysis of the right factors, you can look at the similarities between the two crimes in this particular case. And you look at who both of the victims were. KM and JM, they were both young. They were both individuals who had met the appellant very recently. And both of them had formed a very close relationship very quickly with appellant. KM describes the fact that even though she'd known appellant for a short time, she felt like she'd known him for forever. JM, on the other hand, when she's talking about her relationship with appellant, is describing him as her best friend within just a few weeks of knowing him. So both of these women formed quick relationships with appellant. He starts pushing sexual boundaries and eventually pushes past on several occasions when each of them say no. The incidents described here are very similar, even though the incidents involving KM are only abuse of sexual contact, and the charge involving JM is a rape. You also have to take into consideration there's not a huge temporal proximity between these incidents. They actually happened within a scope of about 6 weeks. Those are just a few of the right factors that I want to highlight in this case, but certainly they weigh in favor of the fact that this evidence, or the evidence of the two sexual assaults, considering them for purposes of propensity, is not substantially more prejudicial than it is probative. And especially if we consider the fact that MRE 413 is a rule of inclusion rather than exclusion, and Congress has indicated that it's supposed to be applied in a broad manner that favors admission, certainly if this court was to conduct its own analysis, it would find that either of these incidents of sexual assault would have been admissible as propensity evidence against the other. Now, even if it was error in this case, which of course the government asserts that it was not, even if it was error for the military judge to give the propensity instruction, there was no material prejudice to a substantial right. This is not an error of constitutional dimension, so again, the proper test is whether or not the error would have had any substantial impact on the findings. Even if the standard was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, even if this was a constitutional error, the evidence in this case was so overwhelming when you consider the fact that appellant essentially confessed to the rape of JM in text messages, that there simply absolutely was no prejudice in this case, and any error was harmless. Again, as appellant has conceded, the propensity instruction that was given in this case was correct. If we look at United States v. Schroeder, which sets out the standards of what must be included in a propensity instruction, that was met in this case in the instruction that was given to the military judge. So again, there is no prejudice. There was no prejudice whatsoever to appellant in this case. So with regard to issue one, appellant has failed to demonstrate any error in the military judge's decision to give the propensity instruction. And even if the military judge did err, appellant suffered no prejudice. His request for relief, as it goes to issue two, should be denied. Now, I don't intend to spend a lot of time talking about Issue 3 because as it stands now and as the court itself has recognized, this court cannot find IAC at this point because it is not offered, it is not ordered affidavits from trial defense counsel. The evidence presented by appellants on appeal simply does not overcome the presumption of competence by trial defense counsel. This court should not, and indeed it cannot, find ineffective assistance of counsel, and therefore appellant's request for relief should be denied. And I'm happy to answer any further questions you might have on Issue 3, but I don't have anything further to say at this particular time.
Is your primary argument on that based on the text message confession? We don't need to hear from the trial defense counsel for you to prevail because of the confession that the accused made in the text message?
Well, I think that there are a lot of reasons, Your Honor, for why the government doesn't believe that what appellant has asserted on appeal overcomes the presumption of competence. I think the first thing that the United States would point to is the evidence that appellant has brought forward. Appellant has only pointed to text messages that were handwritten into a defense counsel's clemency submission. That is not evidence. I mean, appellant could presumably have appended the actual text messages that were pulled for appellant's phone. I mean, we know that that evidence was out there because certain text messages were included in the record of trial. But instead, appellant is only pointing to certain hand-picked or cherry-picked text messages that that trial defense counsel put into the clemency submission. So the government suggests that that is not evidence that this court should be considering, and it certainly is possibly taken completely out of context because there are only certain snippets of those text messages. It's not the full pull from the actual phone.
If we found that the defense counsel fell below the standard of performance required, what's your position on prejudice?
Well, again, Your Honor, our position in this particular case is that when you look at the overwhelming nature of the evidence in support of the conviction for the rape of J.M., that there would be absolutely no prejudice. These text messages, if they had been introduced, they would not have swayed the court members in any way or produced a different outcome in the trial. The text messages just aren't probative, Your Honor. The text messages, when I say the text messages, I'm referring to the ones that appellant's trial defense counsel put into his clemency submission. They happened well before, and I say well before, I mean a couple of weeks before the alleged incident. We have text messages that were actually entered into trial before appellant went over to JM's room on the morning in question. JM said via text messages, you know, you can come over, no sex. And then appellant says, okay, LOL, something to that effect, indicating that he understood or that he agreed with that. And then we have the text messages shortly after the rape occurred where appellant acknowledged that JM said no, but that he essentially didn't care and it just made him want her more and he continued. So given the light of all the other evidence, text messages that occurred several weeks before had very, very little probative value in this case, and they certainly wouldn't have produced a different outcome at trial.
To the extent that the appellant is arguing that JM wasn't credible and the text messages that were admitted in clemency or provided in clemency show that she wasn't a credible witness, couldn't the appellant's response, LOL, when she says no sex, corroborate that notion that he didn't take that statement at face value because of her prior behavior?
I don't think so. If you look at the entire context of the text messages that were available in that clemency submission, Your Honor, I disagree with appellant's counsel saying that they were somehow unequivocal. I think that they were very equivocal. I don't think that the text messages that he points to specifically point to the fact that any sex act specifically occurred on any occasion, and so I don't think that those text messages from the clemency submission raise an indication that JM was somehow being untruthful. Appellant spends time in his brief talking about other clemency submissions in a statement made by appellants at one point to OSI, but that never came into the record. It never came into evidence. And at this point, appellant is not raising IAC for the fact that he was not put on the stand, his trial defense counsel didn't put him on the stand to testify. So I don't believe that that is something that should be in front of this court. And if we just look at the face of the text messages, they're incredibly ambiguous. They are equivocal, and they really do not raise any type of inference that JM was untruthful. And I think it's important to point out that the defense spent a lot of time at trial impeaching JM on her lack of truthfulness. They put up witnesses to testify about that. They cross-examined her on the fact that she had actually deleted some text messages before going to OSI, that she had been untruthful in that particular case about when she went to OSI, about what she was wearing when appellant came over. All of this came out on the record, and the members considered it, and that didn't change their opinion of what happened. Appellant was still convicted. And so these very ambiguous text messages simply would not have added anything to that analysis. And so if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Sure. Thank you.
The military judge did not err in instructing the court members on propensity under Military Rule of Evidence 413. Furthermore, appellant has not overcome the strong presumption that his trial defense counsel were competent. Finally, this court cannot find ineffective assistance of counsel because it has not ordered affidavits from trial defense counsel. Therefore, the United States asks this court to affirm the findings and sentence below. Thank you.
Please, the court, may I have just a second? We did not bring a manual. I was trying to yell at Mr. Bruce during the argument, but I didn't figure the court would want me to. So.
Sure.
No, it's not your fault. My apologies, members of the court. Judge Santoro, I wanted to make sure that I had not inaccurately recited the rule in my brief, and I don't believe I did. I understand the distinction that the court is drawing, which is that the rule requires that that the government shall provide the evidence of the accused, including statements of witnesses. So the rule requires that the evidence be provided, not the actual notice that they plan on using it under 413. However, as the Hutchins court, as this court correctly decided in U.S. v. Hutchins, there is a policy reason why that evidence and the notice under 413 should be provided. The government makes much of the fact that, obviously we disagree, but the government states that the appellant did not object to the 413 evidence. Respectfully, that's why there is a notice requirement. You can't object to what the government doesn't tell you they're not going to introduce.
Well, counsel, the basis for my question and the parsing of the language is this. As you acknowledge, 413, the text of 413 simply says provide the evidence. But if we compare and contrast that with, for example, 412 or 513, both of those rules specifically require motions. And so would we be creating something that the drafters of the rules presumably already knew was a possibility, and that is they could have required motions had they wanted to, but in 413 they arguably affirmatively did not do that. Should we not read into that a conscious choice by the drafter of the rule?
I don't believe that the court should, and it's for the public policy arguments that Your Honor elucidated earlier, which is otherwise there would be no reason for any sort of notice or to provide the evidence. And the court needs to remember that in the typical case, we are not dealing with an instance in which both of the charged allegations can be used sort of on a reverse 413 against each other. What you're normally dealing with is an instance in which the 413 information is completely separate and apart from the charged allegations.
Well, obviously, if Airman Maliwat is facing charges involving only JM, and then a week before trial, he is told by the government, here's all of this evidence involving KM, I think a reasonable fact finder would, or a reasonable defense counsel would then say, well, obviously they plan on using it for that specific purpose. But in this case, as in Hudgens, where there is no indication that the government plans on doing it, then that is why there is a notice requirement. And that is why this court in Hudgens said that the government has to file notice to the defense specifically that we plan on using it under 413.
So let's, again, look at the policy argument, and let's take the following not-so-hypothetical situation. In this case, you've got two alleged sexual assault victims. They're both charged. The evidence comes in with respect to each. There's no discussion of 413 until it's time to discuss instructions. The military judge says, all right, what instructions should I give? If the response from trial defense counsel is, give spillover and only spillover and no 413, doesn't that actually contravene the public policy behind 413, which is Congress has said in drafting the rule they want fact finders to consider this evidence for the purposes for which it's relevant? So, and I'm not sure if I'm articulating.
No, Judge, you may notice the gloss over eyes here. I'm not sure.
I guess what I'm saying is, hasn't Congress, by drafting the rule, said we believe 413 evidence is in fact admissible, probative, for propensity purposes? And so if the military judge gives an instruction that says don't consider it for those purposes, doesn't that go against the public policy for which the rule was created?
Well, I don't believe that the judge is giving an instruction that says don't use it for those purposes.
Well, if he's giving spillover, he would be.
Judge, if you're asking me if the spillover instruction in combination with the 413 instruction make any sense, my answer to that is no. But I'm not sure that's the issue that's before the court today. None of us has been doing this for just for a few weeks. And as many times as I read the combination of 413 and the spillover instruction, no, I cannot make any sense of it.
But I guess my point is, in this particular case, if the military judge had not given the 413 instruction and instead he had given the spillover instruction, would that decision not have contravened the policy that underlies 413?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, I think that it's important that the court understand that our argument is not with the instruction per se. Our argument is with the lack of notice and the failure to put the balancing test on the record. So if you're asking me, in a clean, sterile world, is the instruction proper and was it done correctly in this case, we have said yes. But we're not in that clean, sterile world because, quite candidly, it appears like a lot of what happened in this case was done during an 802. Kind of feels like they all come out and said, well, this is what the defense has said that they're going to object to. That's not clear. But again, and it goes back to Judge Keller's question, whose job is it to clear this up for the record? It's the military judge's job. And he's the one that should have said, here is the reason why I am going to give this instruction and why I believe that this evidence was admissible for that purpose.
From a policy standpoint, how should we view the fact that the defense counsel, if they felt so strongly about evidence being used both for propensity and the charge defense, didn't raise a motion in limine to bring that to the court's attention?
Because they didn't know the government was going to use it for that purpose.
But they certainly knew the evidence was out there, and they certainly know that Congress believes it's relevant.
Well, certainly so, Judge. But that's exactly why we get back to why there is a notice requirement under the rules.
If we took your position, wouldn't we be allowing the defense to sit on their hands and put the military judge in an untenable position?
No, Judge, you're putting the government on notice, as the government has asked in their own pleadings, that you should provide notice to the defense of these, that you're going to do this. I mean, that's what the Army Court has done, that's what the Navy Court has done, and that's what this court should do. I don't always agree with Mr. Bruce, but in this case, I actually do, that they should put that evidence, or that they should put that notice, provide that notice to the defense. Any more questions with regards to assignment of error 2? I will move very briefly to assignment of error 3. The government says that we have not overcome the presumption of competence. Respectfully, I think that the caveat to that is yet, which is why in my discussions with Judge Hecker, we were discussing U.S. v. Lewis and its progeny and how that impacts this case.
Could you talk about prejudice real quick, though, with regard to...
Oh, absolutely, Judge. I think it's important to realize that the defense counsel obviously felt that these texts were relevant.
and they weren't created out of whole cloth. They were, you know, I don't think there's any evidence before this court that the defense counsel made these things up and provided them to the convening authority. So the defense counsel obviously felt that they were relevant, that they may lead to the overturning of his client's conviction, as noted in the last paragraph. Why is that? The reason is because
I'd really like to, because of the amount of time you have left.
That's where I'm heading.
I would really like to for you to focus on the reasonable probability that had these been admitted, the result would have been different.
That's where I'm headed, Judge.
Right.
Between the no sex discussion and the night in question, it is obvious that J.M. was violating, for lack of a better term, her no sex policy. That is what these text messages indicate. Or that Airman Maliwat reasonably believed that as a result of these text messages, which occurred between the no sex talk.
But that belief has to be both subjective and objectively reasonable.
Which we believe it is.
And how do you square that with the text messages just after the charge down?
Judge, we don't have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the result would have been different. We have to show that there is a reasonable likelihood, a reasonable probability that there would be. And that is why these text messages would reasonably tend, as Your Honor himself indicated, to diminish. You know, and the government's argument seems to be the panel already knew that she was a liar, so showing that she's a really big liar wouldn't have made that much of a difference. Respectfully, we disagree. Respectfully, we disagree that this is a confession. It is, you know, and those of us who do this on the trial level see this all the time, where the accused attempts to calm down, for lack of a better term, the alleged victim. These text messages, which show that they had at least certainly a panel could find that they showed that they had sexual contact in between the time of the we're not going to have sex.
Is the test that the panel could find, or is this panel reasonably would
reasonably
have
likely to find?
This panel.
Yes, sir. And we believe that they would have. And for those reasons, as it relates to assignment of error 2, we ask that this court reverse the conviction, or as it relates to assignment of error 3, that this court follow United States v. Lewis and its progeny.
I have one more question for you.
Yes, sir.
Sorry about that. It's on the counsel issue. As obviously you know, you've raised the allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel. In response to that, the government asked us to order briefs from trial defense counsel to discern what the tactical strategy may or may not have been. You opposed that. What, if anything, should we make of your efforts to preclude us or to get us not to order affidavits?
I don't think you should make anything of it, because what the rule requires is that, in other words, the court has to look at it. Once the government has had a chance to respond, the government now has had a chance to respond. If they filed that request tomorrow, we would not oppose it.
Thank you.
And subject to any further questions from members of the court, that concludes our presentation. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments, and this court will issue a decision in due course.